Welcome to the Not Sorry Art Podcast. I'm Sari Shrike, the artist and creator behind Not Sorry Art. I'm so excited to talk art and creativity with you, so grab a drink, grab a snack, and let's dive in. I also wanted to say that today's episode is sponsored by my book. I have a book coming out. I'm so proud of this, guys. The links are already up. I'll have them in the show notes. But the book is called Modern Still Life, From Fruit Bowls to Disco Balls. It is my take on a step-by-step painting book. I am really excited about it. Not only does it have like motivational tips and tricks to keep you going in your practice, but it also has clear and beautiful and full color breakdowns of the step-by-step process in my paintings. So I could not be more excited about it. If you wanted to check it out, pre-order it. Hello, welcome back to the Not Sorry Art Podcast. I'm Sari. Thanks for being here. Today's episode is called Care for Your Creature and Challenge Your Creativity. I was looking for a good alliteration there. Maybe one of you guys can think of a better one, but it doesn't matter. I'm going to explain the entire concept behind that. And basically, it's a concept that, whether knowingly or unknowingly, I have worked off of for kind of my whole creative life, and I'm excited to share it with you guys because, as always, it's a reframing tool to help you sort of know where to put your energy. That's something, as I think a business owner and like certainly as a parent, I always feel like I'm floundering in, but I've always felt like I've had a good sense of it when it comes to my creative practice. Maybe I should introspect on that now that I say that. But I want to share this concept with you, the idea of what it means to care for your creature and what it looks like to challenge your creativity, and why I think that's the path to being a more actualized version of yourself artistically. I will elaborate. I always love these episodes because they feel like a bit of a pep talk, and I think that that's me at my best. Something to know is that I deeply care for artists. I think the world is a better place with more artists in it when people own their creativity, because I think to be a human is to be creative. Full stop. Not everyone's creative in the same way. Creative could be you are a wizard on Excel sheets. Creative could be you are the life of the party. You know how to glue people together and create community. And obviously, creative can be dancing and painting and singing too. But I also know that it feels like in some ways in 2024, there's more opportunities than ever to be creative. I think of things like social media. I think we're having kind of a bit of a creative or crafty renaissance at the moment. Maybe that's just my echo chamber. But I also think that it's a hard time to be creative. I think it's economically a hard time to be a person. And even in, you know, the United States, which in very many ways is a very privileged country, it's still hard at every rung, I think, to, you know, I think we all have challenges, and I think I'm glossing over a lot of that. And I do not mean to be glib, but I think what I'm offering up with this episode is, again, a reframing device on it. So let me explain creature right out the gate. To understand this is to understand something that I call in my family creature days. So I have two young kids and my husband, and we, you know, every summer, sometimes in the fall or winter, we do long road trips, right? We live in the middle of this country. So, you know, a 14-hour bomb is just part of what we do. So a lot of times when we have a long travel day, we will have what is called a creature day, which is where the day we get somewhere, depending on what time of day we arrive, we will really focus on making sure that everyone's regulated, sort of physically and emotionally, whatever that looks like. So what that can be is we're staying in, we're going to take naps, we're going to have three square meals with protein and fiber. We're going to, you know, if one kid needs to live on top of me for a day, that's fine. If one kid needs to go run around and roughhouse with dad and get that energy out, that's what we do. And I will say, like, it's hard because sometimes you go to somewhere cool, you know, and you're in a desert in New Mexico and White Sands is like 30 minutes this way, and you want to go do stuff. And I have found it to be much more, I don't know, advantage to our family's culture to spend a day really caring for our physical, emotional needs, our more basic needs that we all have. I suppose if we can look at the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, if we can get back to our middle school health class, we can say that we're taking care of some of those core fundamental base needs first before we go and do fun things, so that we are regulated and can enjoy them and can marvel at White Sands and can marvel at wherever we travel to look at and experience, and we can be more social and we can do all the things that are higher up on that hierarchy because we are cared for. And I find this to be empowering. Obviously, not everyone has to do this. Some people are like, you know, first day in New York, I'm going to go do everything. And I get that. And excitement is one heck of a fuel. So I get it. But it's something that transforms, I think, into my own practice. For background, you know, I used to be a college athlete, and this informs a lot of what I do. I bring it up a lot, but it wasn't just that I was a college athlete. It's like my basis of how I understand commitment, endurance, being kind to myself, listening to my body, all stems from those, you know, that decade of my life, a very intense decade. You know, I got to where I, for a while in college, was running like 90-mile weeks, doing yoga, lifting weights. It was very intense. But as you increase your training, there is also this big push to listen to your body. That was a phrase that was thrown around by coaches. That was a phrase that the trainers would use all the time. You know, when you're in college and you're an athlete, you do get kind of dedicated training staff for, you know, different sports, whatever. And recovery and care of your physical body was very important. What this often looked like in college was long naps on Sundays. So Sundays were a long run day. Admittedly, I always ended up working, but that was part of why, like, my coach was always like, don't have a job because you need to physically take care of yourself. I had extenuating circumstances where I needed financially to cover things. So I probably would have been a better athlete had I not. But to the best of my ability, I would try to rest and recover as much as I could. And, you know, eating enough calories, that's another thing. I know that getting into the world of diets, and I'm not going to tiptoe. It's just not something I'm interested in. But there was this idea that you did need to make sure you had a good fuel. You needed to have carbohydrates. You needed to have fiber. You needed to make sure you were getting enough sugar and electrolytes when you were training. It was this taking care of the body. And a phrase that was thrown around a lot is whenever you were doing a workout, especially if you were sort of, you had a almost injury, or you're recovering from an injury, or it's mid-season, which is when a lot of people get injured, there was a constant dialogue about, like, listen to your body. And the reason for that is because a lot of training involves tremendous discomfort. Heck, I'll say it, pain even, right? It's this, when you're doing your laps and your repetitions, you know, 800 drills, so running half mile, you know, 10, 15 times, plus a warm up, plus a cool down, right? Something that intense, you, especially once you hit that threshold where you're getting into that workout, your body, everything physically is telling you to stop. But one skill that you have to develop that's just as important in the case of running as good leg turnover, good strength, good stability, good core strength, good flexibility, just as important is the ability inside of your brain to be able to look down at yourself and say, is this hurting because I am pushing myself physically, or is this hurting because my knee is injured, or my hip is injured, or my body's telling me there's something wrong? And I think if you hadn't gradually developed that, and I'm going to call it a skill, it's not just like you do it and you don't do it. You have to get good at listening. It is its own unique skill set. But once you develop that, and we all make mistakes, but that can save your season. It's really, really important. And it's something that I've carried over, I think, into the rest of my life. Certainly, it shows up in how I parent. I'm really, you know, we're really into routine as a family. We're really into, like, structure and boundaries and creature days. And it doesn't have to be a vacation. Like, sometimes it's just like right now, we're kind of doing summer things. My kids are in camps and, you know, we're doing the pool, and it's a lot, and summers are important, and I love having children. Anyways, so we might have a random creature day. You know, we're doing a lot. We're staying up late to watch fireworks. Hey, let's have a day where nobody does anything. We don't say yes. We don't sign up for anything, and we just stay home, or we stay in the yard, and we just take care of our physical forms. This is important. Now, I say all this. This is a lot of like, okay, great, Sarah, you're telling me to, like, drink water and rest. I'm saying this because within the context of being creative, there's this big push to, like, you're not creative if you're not pushing yourself. And I think a lot of us, myself included, and a lot of my friends, and a lot of people I look up to, and a lot of people, I see this a lot, and I get it. And I'm not saying, like, I can gauge what they're doing. But I think a lot of people would benefit from developing that internal barometer of knowing when to push themselves. And I will add to this how to push themselves and how hard. What I see is this romanticization of burning the candle at both ends, staying up late, painting and editing. And I'm not saying some people are night owls. That's fine. That's I'm not. But pushing yourself past what you know to be good for your body. And like you're only as dedicated as you're willing to push. And I think that that's a very toxic trope. I do think that there needs to be push and consistency, 100%. Again, that athletic background, I'm not going to sit here and be like, roll over and do nothing. But again, it's a self-barometer. It's not against what anyone else's output looks like. Of course, I hope that's a given. But the other thing is because I also think that while people tend to push themselves, staying up late, committing themselves to so many social outings or, you know, pushing themselves on social media or sharing and being vulnerable on social media constantly, I think, and I have a hard time listing this off because it's going to be different for everyone. This is really one of those internal barometer things, but pushing their physical and emotional selves when what they, I think they should be pushing, if we're getting back to the running analogy, is like the effort in like the thing that you're training for. So for creatives, for artists, it's your creativity. Okay, what do you mean by push yourself creatively? The thing is, I think we often conflate pushing ourselves physically, burning the candle at both ends, staying up late, working a job, putting in a ton of creative, making one new painting a week, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then we don't actually push ourselves creatively. So this is where like I always hesitate with like the tough love part of this conversation. But I'm going to introduce a concept called constraintivity. I think I've mentioned it before, but I love this concept. And it's the idea that your constraints actually shape your creativity. It's actually a good thing. I think the concept of like the benefit of constraintivity is often up against the like, you can't tell me what to do-ness of like my culture. So America, the United States, where we, especially creatively, we really don't like to be told what to do. And I think that that's, again, I like to think that maybe it has something to do with Americanness, but I also think that perhaps we haven't had enough conversations or we're not aware of it, or maybe people just do it and they don't talk about it very much or they don't externalize it. Certainly, I think that's the case for me. I'm not saying I'm some perfect example of this. This is just a dialogue that I keep going personally. Okay, so like one way I see this conversation is in the idea of sort of like copying other artists. Okay, I know, hold your tomatoes. I get sick of this conversation too. It's just an important framework of which I view the world, so bear with me. But I've seen in myself and in lots and lots of other artists, again, if this is just a Sari needing to vent moment, I would journal it and it would be good. But I see happen a lot in these conversations in the art world where someone is very clearly directly being inspired to the point of perhaps full-on copying with a resistance to crediting happening. And what ends up happening in the dialogue, which is always what I think is the most interesting, is people are like, well, you don't own this idea. Like then they couldn't, you know, they have an idea, like just let them do it. And that only makes sense, I think, if we have a fear that we don't have enough creativity to come up with something ourselves. And the thing is, I know people, and even the people who are like, kind of do this a lot, have it in themselves to be creative. I think creativity is like anything. It's a muscle. You know, I think it's everyone has the potential to be creative, and that your creativity is not a response to just like something super innate. Again, aptitude, sure. But it's a response to how much are you challenging yourself creatively? How many constraints do you have or have you gone through to push yourself creatively? Because one thing I do, and I'm not saying everyone has to do this, everyone's what their constraints are is going to be reflective of their own everything. Morals, creed, how much time they have, how much energy they have, who they look up to. And I can't tell you what that is for you, and you can't tell me what that is for me. And I, you know, okay, I'm, yeah. But when I think of ideas and when I'm coming up with concepts, I have a lot of things that I use as very intentional constraints that I think make my artistry more creative. I don't know better, but more creative. And that is, if I come up with an idea and I see that someone else has done it, either historically, but more certainly is a current artist living off of that idea. You know, they're feeding their kids on that concept. I will not do it unless it's like so, so vital. You know, it's a theme that I've worked with for years. It's class, it's gender, it's color, it's plastic. Okay, I might be willing to make that and then just tag the person and be ethical and, you know, et cetera. But 99.9% of the time, I tell myself, great, keep digging, push harder, keep thinking on it. You can do it. It's the opposite and the counteraction to having a creature day, to being like, I might make more money if I make myself make something and post it. I might make more money if I put in the work and creating a new product, a new concept, a new idea, something to sell, but I need to take care of myself and my kids and my family. It's the counter to that. If we're creative, these things swing in tandem. And so I would rather take steps back that if I can, and if I can afford them, and I know there's privilege in that concept, but if I can, I would physically rather take a step back and then push myself creatively. Other constraints, because it's not just about the copying. That's just a example and one specific point. Another example is mediums. So I know in my core that I would be the kind of person who would jump from idea to idea if I could. And could, again, that's one of those like you could, but it's a constraint that I intentionally set. You know, I recently did a podcast with Ekaterina Popova from Create Magazine. I adore her. And, you know, she was asking me like, what do you say about like jumping around mediums and like, how do you stick to one? You're very disciplined in that one medium. And again, a lot of my discipline is a virtue of my privilege. So I'm not painting myself up to be something fancy and special because I'm not. But I remember early on having this insight of like, if you're going to gain traction, whether it's social media or in a gallery scene or whatever, getting better at your craft, you're going to have to make yourself pick a medium. And hopefully the lessons, the ideas, the concepts, things like weight and color and silhouette and composition would translate if I say wanted to get into fashion or sculpture later, right? There'd be a learning curve, but as a 22-year-old, 23-year-old, I am going to give myself the credibility that getting very good at one medium allots you as an artist in 2024. Is that fair? No, I have a whole episode dedicated to the jack of all trades. I think that's the way most of us are meant to be creative, but in our current society, it does not support that. And so I made a constraint for myself of you're going to stick to painting. Now, within the scope of painting, I have allowed myself a lot of range. And I will say, I think that's why I have a whole body of work kind of dedicated to the, I always butcher this, bear with me, trompe l'oeil, I think. It's French, I always say it wrong, but it's this idea of optical illusion. It's where the idea of the disco ball came from. All the while, I wanted to sign up for ceramics classes and sculpture classes, and I still have to fight myself every day to not just go play with air clay, which I might be able to afford later. Don't count me out. But I stop myself and allow myself to push the limits of how three-dimensional, how interactive can I make a two-dimensional surface? And I think that, you know, my disco ball, my eight balls, my pearls, my recent little hamster ball, I know it's a concept, it's a trope, but I don't think I would have gotten there had I not limited myself in some way, made it a real constraint for myself. And so limits don't have to be bad, you know? In fact, I think they can be incredibly helpful. One more example of a limit, and then I'll move on to my next idea. It has to do more with the conceptual aspect of my work. So I make a lot of work around color, class, gender. And when it comes to discussing class, especially as a white person, because there is tremendous privilege in being white, even when you are living at below the poverty line as a kid, right? You know, female, kid, poverty, those are pretty heavy burdens to carry. However, I know that my whiteness offered me a ton of privilege. And, you know, unfortunately, the nature of privilege is that you don't often see it, right? It's an invisible crown that you wear. Not to say that the privilege is a good thing. I'm just saying within the context of our culture, it allots you undue advantages. And so I tread very carefully when I make class art. So like one of my And I have it written out, because I'm really passionate about constraints are so powerful. One of my constraints I have is, could someone who maybe feels the burden of class and maybe you know, lives in a rural part of the country and feels in some way victimized, which on a class basis makes sense, but feels, but carries that victimization over to their racial identity, which is not, in my opinion, correct at all. And they might be, you know, kind of, I want to be careful with my words here. I don't want to get too into the deep end, but, you know, they might be someone who gravitates towards more fascist ideology, who feels disenfranchised by their economic situation, and then chooses hating on your neighbor as an outlet for that. And unfortunately, there's a lot of television out there that really profits off of that emotional charge. But all that to say, I'm painting that picture because one of my limits is, could someone in that particular ideology take any of the work that I make about class and feel gratified in a way that isn't constructive or that tears down that really harmful ideology that spins out of that economic disadvantage? If they can take my work and not have that mindset challenged or even like feels good in a way that doesn't challenge those unhealthy parts of that belief, then I don't make that work. So, you know, that's why a lot of what the commentary I make around class has to do with aesthetics. You know, it's not just depicting, you know, poor rural Americans and saying like, hey, they suffer too, because not to say that that's bad art or that if someone else makes that's bad art. Again, it is totally a deeper inner, I journal about this, I think about this, I carry this around, it shapes who I am. Not to say that everyone should have to hold themselves, because someone else might have better skill at doing a better job of that conversation. I'm just saying that it's a constraint that I've put up, and it allows me to push myself in a different direction. And it's just as important as the colors I choose, as the subject matter I choose. Those constraints are more important than my paintbrushes, honestly. And it's what shapes my concepts, my morality, my everything, really. And I think back to sort of the origin of this concept for me, because I don't think it started when I was 15 years old, you know, the first time I started getting really into running. And a lot of that was just getting out of the house, right? And I loved it, and I fell in love with it, and I loved the, you know, the accountability, the rawness, the objectivity of running, like just felt very passionate about it. But I would say that my belief in the fact that creativity grows when it's challenged, and that to be able to be fortunate enough to sort of pick your limitations, came from a time and a place when I was forced to be creative and I did not get to pick my limitations. So whenever I was a kid, I can remember, I have a couple of very clear memories. I'll paint two of them for you. So one of them was, I used to love the show Zoom. It came on PBS, and it was like a group of kids, and they would do like skits, and they always had like crafts or like little recipes. And I remember they would always list the supplies you're supposed to have, and then you made it. And I have so many memories of not having like most of what they said. You know, my mom was very kind, and she always brought home paper, and we had scissors, and I think I usually had like colored pencils, but we didn't have like a fully stocked craft cabinet. My kids, pipe cleaners, all of it, that, you know, they have all that stuff. And we were poor. My mom did her best, but we didn't have a lot of stuff. And so I remember so clearly walking into like my linen closet, looking at my toy box that my sister and I share, a little cardboard box in our closet, and like taking toys apart. And I remember making so much out of like cardboard from toilet paper or old like cans and food wrappers, and just collecting those things and sort of like being a rat with them, but using a lot of things like that in place of it. And my mom, who very tired, and both my parents are really slow to give compliments, but I remember my mom frequently would be like, wow, that's really creative. And another memory I have is remembering that I really wanted to make dolls. You know, we, again, poor, so we got, my parents always really tried to have Christmas. That was, I think, Christmas and having something for dinner was always their, you know, maybe couldn't guarantee lunch, but we always had. Anyways, and so that, for as a December birthday, that left a lot of the year where we didn't get anything. So I really wanted to have like a little doll family. And I remember using hair curlers, like the sponge curlers, and I hot glued a walnut, or I don't know how, I think I hot glued a walnut, and then I used string for arms, and I was able to use like Barbie clothes on it. Anyways, and I remember that I made a little family of dolls, and I played with those forever. So I just have these memories as a kid of like walking in my house and thinking, what can I use for something else? And I do think that that's like a fantastic exercise for someone. In fact, I kind of do that with my kids sometimes where I'm like, can you make something out of this? Or go look in the yard and figure out how to do, because I think it's such a good, you know, again, I don't think that I'm naturally anything special. I think that when you have a whole childhood of not being able to consume your way, you know, via your parents, out of every moment of boredom and every trend you can't catch on to, you begin to really trust your creativity and it becomes bigger. And it's something, it was like the only area of my life that I ever had any confidence. I was like, well, if given enough time, I can think my way out of it. And I think that that's such a powerful tool where I want you guys to all have creative practices. I want you all to feel experience what it feels like to have a really robust sense of creativity. But I also think that it would improve, like I said in the beginning, the world is better with more artists in it. And I don't think that just because I think there needs to be more wall space taken up. I think that because when there are people who feel empowered by their creativity, it frees them from the shackles of feeling like they have to consume their way out of every emotion and problem. And to get to the top of the episode, you know, we live in a time where there feels like there's problems everywhere. And it's not to say that one person is individually going to solve it. But I think if we have a populace that feels more confident with their creativity, I just think not only would it, I think in the moment, give us a little more peace and power that we could solve it, but I do think that ultimately it would result in more solutions. I know that's big speak. That's just me being pie in the sky, but I mean, I do feel it. My last example, and this is in a weird order, I apologize, is a theory I've had forever about the sophomore slump. So I don't know if you guys are familiar with it. I think it's in music. It might be in other things. I don't know if it's like a book industry thing or what, but within, at least I know, the music world, there's this idea that people get what's called a sophomore slump. And usually the concept is it's because they've been writing that first album their whole life. And then by the time they get to their sophomore album, they have like an album cycle, so a year or two, to produce an entire other body of work that matches. And the thing is, I don't know that I fully believe that. Okay, maybe kind of, especially if the first album came out for someone in their like late 20s or 30s. Okay, yes, you're firing at all cylinders by that age. I get it. Or if somebody, you know, just really shows, you know, has a lot of creative output at a young age. There are exceptions to everything. But my personal theory is that a lot of times I think what happens is your first album is full of constraints. And those constraints make you who you are. And I have this theory because one of my favorite things to do is watch music documentaries. I love them so much. So much of the time, like that first album, it's like you're filming, you know, you're making music in a tin can, or like Bon Iver's first breakthrough album, I think, like his like signature sound came because he was like in a cabin and that's all he had access to. And it was constrained simply by his limitations, but it ended up becoming a signature sound. And this is, I'm thinking of just Bon Iver for this one instance, but it's like you, once you see it, you start seeing it everywhere. So everyone, the first, you know, or like the first real album, it's these, so you're not in, you haven't been let in, you're still on the outside, you still have these constraints. Once you've had a successful album, the record executives, you know, see dollar signs in their eyes, and you now have access to the nicest studios and the best producers and a full orchestra. And I think sometimes artists can live up and match that energy. I'm thinking of like a Brian Wilson with Pet Sounds, where he really lived up to, here are all your options that you are on option lists. And I think that takes one kind of mind and a certain kind of artist to be able to do that. But I see so many times with the sophomore slump, my theory is that what ends up happening is you don't have enough constraints you've built into yourself as a person, or maybe you don't know to do that, or a lot of times I think all this stuff is subconscious. And I think the limitlessness of it, the optionlessness of it, the like I can work with a Pharrell of it all, I think totally trips people up. And I think that there's power in constraints. And I think when we see those constraints, we think, oh, it's another limit, it's a barrier. And last thing I'll say, it reminds me of like the Serenity Prayer. My parents had it hanging in their house my whole childhood. And I think it goes like, give me the strength to take on my challenges, or something like that. The serenity when I can't, and the wisdom to know the difference. And so I think with creativity, I think so much of the power is like you pick your battles with your constraints, the wisdom to know the difference between a constraint worth fighting. And I, because I want to be careful, not all constraints are good constraints. A gallery being prejudiced to someone is not a good constraint. You know, it's that's one worth alerting all the neighbors and having everyone band together and fight for you. But and not every problem needs to be romanticized. I'm sure I'm thinking of stuff where someone else is like, that's a romanticized problem. Doesn't count. Doesn't count. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying some constraints, and especially the ones that you are lucky enough to choose for yourself, can be your best tools and your best assets. So that's my encouragement. I know it probably doesn't feel, by the end of the episode, it probably doesn't feel like much of a pep talk because I just told you to like be tougher. But ease into it. Ease into it. Start by taking care of yourself. Go take a nap. It's not glamorous to burn yourself out at both ends of the candle. Go take a nap. It's if you can afford to, relax. Be kinder to yourself. You don't have to be killing yourself to be a good artist. But there's power in putting some of that intensity to understanding what good limitations might look like. So thank you for listening to this episode. I hope it's encouraging. If you have any questions about it, as always, feel free to email me or message me or leave a review. Those are always helpful. I also wanted to shout out that this episode is brought to you by Not Sorry Art School. It's my online art school. I teach how to paint representationally, paint in my style. I'm really proud of it. We are starting a new cycle of new videos coming up in August, how to paint fabric and pattern. I'm very proud of it. It's a fantastic series. And no, you don't just have to want to paint fabric to do it. It's also about learning how to paint stuff that's detailed, flat, two-dimensional, how to create depth with your painting. I'm, again, very, very proud of it. It's a wonderful lesson with lots of great resources and tools. I also wanted to say I have a couple spots left on my Spain trip. It's coming up. It is the last week of September, and I would love to get those final spots filled if you want to be able to do future retreats with me. Unfortunately, it kind of hinges on the the ability to sell these out. So if you're interested in that, might be your last chance. There's a couple spots left. And all that to say, as always, I deeply appreciate you guys taking the time to listen to me if you've made it this far. I appreciate you. I always appreciate the feedback that you guys give me, and happy creating. Feel power in pushing yourself creatively, and I'm rooting for you. I also wanted to take a quick moment to thank everyone who has taken the time to leave a review and leave feedback. As always, it is incredibly helpful. This week, I'd like to shout out Chronically Witchy for their feedback. I always appreciate it. If you would like to have your name or handle read off on next week's episode, be sure to leave me a review. As always, it's so helpful. Thank you again. Happy creating, and I'll talk to you guys next week.